Show Me the Science with Professor Luke O'Neill. A new podcast series from Newstalk.
Welcome to this week's podcast, Show Me the Science. I'm Luke O'Neill and I'm very happy to talk about different science topics every week. And these are topics that fascinate me. I am first and foremost a scientist, remember, and I've got lots of training in science. I did spend, 3 years doing a PhD in science. I did specialise. But these topics, I look through the lens of science. What can science tell us about these things? And I very much go for data to back up what I'm saying. And everything I tell you, there's evidence to support this from a scientific point of view. Now, this week, it's the winter, isn't it? We're going to talk about the science of the cold. Cold weather, what does it do to us? And how does it affect our bodies? And I love the cold. I'm one of these people who quite like the winter, the crispy, frosty mornings. Now, of course, it can get miserable with cloud and rain and everything. But isn't the winter wonderful? Things are quiet. And if it snows, isn't that a wonderful lift for us all? So I'm fascinated by the cold. I'm by the Arctic and the Antarctic. What kind of creatures live there? We're going to talk about how the animals survive in these really cold temperatures. And probably one of the hottest, there's a word for the cold, one of the hottest topics at the moment is winter swimming. Never before in the history of humanity have so many people plunged in ice cold water than at this time because of COVID, I guess, is one reason for that. Is there a basis for swimming in the cold? And guess what? There is. There's good news there as well. So we're going to talk on several aspects about the cold. Now, us humans, we evolved not to be in the cold. We're called tropical animals. We evolved in Africa. When it never gets cold, it never goes below 25 degrees if you're living in the savannah of Africa, for example, So our bodies are built to live in warm weather. So, of course, what the hell has happened? We moved out of those regions and began to live in colder climates. I've often thought when the first people came to Ireland, whenever it was, probably 10,000 years ago now, I would have turned around and gone back to Africa. Like, why would you spend the winter here, for crying out loud? It seems a bit strange, doesn't it? There are two reasons why we humans managed to leave Africa and go to live in colder places, and it was technology. We were very inventive as a species. We spotted how to make fire. That was a big one, obviously. And then the second thing is how to use animal hides. We knew there were animals had evolved to live in the cold. If you're a polar bear, you don't live in Africa. Your body has evolved to live in the cold parts of the world. And then we knew, let's use their hide and wrap it around ourselves. And then we can live in the cold. And they were the two main reasons we could move up to northern regions or southern regions as well, of course, to survive in these regions. So we could use technology, very observant as creatures. But we're built to live in tropical climates, I guess, and not in the cold. Now, we know cold is bad for us. And this is the science of hypothermia. It can be very serious if people get caught out in the cold. This was first seen, obviously, as we move into northern areas and people didn't have the hide, didn't have fire. We can die of hypothermia. It's a very serious thing. And again, that's one of the more serious bits of this, that can you protect people from hypothermia in various ways. But if you take all your clothes off and you stand in a room and the temperature is below 20, you will begin to feel a chill. So we know then that we're not really meant to be in that environment unless we put clothes on, I suppose, and light a fire. So we're not built for it, but then we can use ways to keep ourselves warm, I guess. And this has been studied a huge amount. Now, it was mainly studied in the army, for instance, because they knew soldiers would be in cold regions and could they protect them against hypothermia, for instance. And now in Antarctica, there's a whole research area of this trying to study hypothermia in various ways. And more seriously, if someone, say, is in the sea and comes out and they've got hypothermia, can we warm them up? So there's ways to protect against this, I guess. But what happens to your body when you're in the cold? Well, the first thing that happens is, guess what? You start to shiver. Now, we all have had this, haven't we? Now, that's a very interesting response because you're shivering to generate heat. And your muscle, when it twitches as it shivers, generates 5 times the amount of heat as it would when it's not shivering. So our bodies can respond to the cold. I guess that was evolved as well, that if someone in Africa did somehow get a bit cold for whatever reason, they would start to shiver. And that's the first response to this. The second thing is you get goosebumps. And we all know about goosebumps, don't we? What's happening there is the hair is standing up and that will trap air. And air is a bit warmer. So again, the goosebump response is part of this as well. And then a funny one, you do go red in the face. Now, that was a bit of a mystery because eventually, of course, all the blood drains from your skin to conserve your body temperature inside. You've got to keep the heart and the brain at the right temperature, otherwise it won't work. So you're kind of trying to conserve heat by getting the blood away from the skin, because the blood might get cold and then travel to your heart and cool down the heart. But yet it does seem to oscillate back and forth. That's a recent discovery. So the blood rushes up to your skin and then rushes into the middle of your body. And the red face is because of the blood rushing out to the skin. It's a strange one. But eventually that all stops and you get very, very pale. And that's a sure sign of hypothermia. But that flushing of the face in this early phase of being cold is seen as possibly quite a good thing. That sort of drives some kind of response, I guess. So these changes happen. But then sadly, of course, you will get colder and colder. As the blood drains from your limbs, that can then freeze, and that's frostbite. And there's various studies showing how to stop that happening. And that's the more serious end, I guess, of getting cold. The frostbite in the extremities is a big part of this. They've also looked at how people can tolerate the cold. Now, you would have a friend, I've got friends like this, who are cold in the slightest draft. They put a coat on. What's wrong with you? You know, so there's vary between us. My mother-in-law can sense a draft at 500 yards, I think. There's the door open, you know. So some people, it differs between us, doesn't it, in a way, how we tolerate this. But a very interesting study is, it turns out that sex is a factor. The people, and this was a surprise when I saw this, the people who can tolerate cold the most are young Caucasian women. For some reason, they're better able to tolerate the cold. The ones who are worst are non-Caucasian, non-white elderly men. They are more susceptible to hypothermia. We think with young women, they've got a layer of subcutaneous fat that kind of keeps them warm, I suppose. But it's a very interesting study that different people can tolerate the fat. You can certainly become desensitized to it. So if you swim in the sea, back to that one in a minute, you get used to it a bit and you can tolerate it a bit more. So it could be kind of psychological as to how we tolerate the cold or not, I suppose. But there's interesting differences between people. Now, another really interesting bit, this is the bit that really interests me actually most of all, is how can animals that are naturally living in the cold, how do they survive it? And we've seen polar bears, we've seen penguins, all kinds of creatures live in very cold climates. The first response is some hibernate. They get away from the cold. You know, things like bears will hibernate, frogs hibernate. The daddy of them all, in my opinion, for this is the Arctic ground squirrel.
He spends his entire winter asleep. Out like a light for 8 months straight.
That creature can almost freeze in when it gets really cold and then comes out in the spring, you know, and its body is able to tolerate huge cold. It keeps its head slightly above zero because obviously the brain can't freeze. Otherwise you get, guess what? Brain freeze. But the squirrel is able to maintain its body in this sort of, you know, sort of suspended animation state. And this is a fascination. What have those creatures got that allow them to almost freeze? Well, guess what? They make a natural antifreeze. There's things called glycoproteins that stop ice crystals forming. And again, this could be useful in various ways to treat hypothermia, say. The real interest of this is, say, an organ transplantation. Can you freeze a kidney and then thaw it out for use later? The risk is all the ice will destroy that kidney. Give the kidney the natural antifreeze. And they're doing that. They're keeping organs, you know, kind of semi-alive, I suppose, before a transplantation. So again, there's a useful application, understanding how other animals do it. And then we can use that to, say, keep organs from freezing, I suppose. And the other one is cryonics, of course, to freeze bodies. But that's a different topic that isn't really in the realm of science at the moment. But certainly the notion of animals sustaining themselves in these ice-cold temperatures could have uses. Now, I also love, I'm a huge lover of nature, as we all. I became a scientist partly because I love the natural world. It's the most beautiful thing, isn't it? Look at these wonderful whales. They have loads of blubber that stop them from getting cold. Seals have lots of blubber. And very interesting that they can overheat. Like, it's all very well to put a really, you know, layer of blubber on, but what if the sun comes out? Guess what? The flippers and the fluke of the whale, the tail of the whale, that's got loads of blood vessels and can dissipate heat should they overheat. These are tremendous machines that can live in these freezing cold conditions and sustain themselves in that way. Now, a key part of this is nutrition. So you have to eat. Now, we eat for nutrients, but guess what? You burn the fuel to stay warm, and we maintain our body temperature at 37 through nutrition. And it's a bit like putting coal in a boiler, I suppose. The blue whale eats 4 tons of krill a day in the Arctic Oceans, and then that's the source of fuel to keep its temperature up. They're warm-blooded like us, I guess. And then, of course, the dangerous part of this is a fever. And humans, as we all know with COVID, sometimes your temperature spikes, it gets higher. Now, this is a response actually to fight the germ, because if your body is slightly warmer, your immune system likes that increased temperature. The cells move a bit faster and they can kill the infection with a slight temperature, and it's a natural response. And so therefore we can raise our body temperature through a fever response. The trouble is this can become very damaging, and fever is an important part of some of these diseases as well. But all animals that are warm-blooded can mount a fever to help fight infection, and it's a very important part of the response. And then your temperature comes down again once you've fought the infection. But it's a fascination, these animals have all these ways of doing it. Another one I love is, great word now, huddling. Isn't that nice? Now, penguins, as you may have seen in Antarctica.
Now they have darkness, savage winds, nothing to eat, and nothing to do but take their turn at the edge of the huddle and shuffle.
All huddle together to stay warm in the winter, and that's conserving, obviously, the heat they've got. This also tells us something. Very few small animals can survive the cold because they've got this awful sort of a surface area to volume ratio problem. They dissipate heat too quickly. If you're a big animal, you can maintain your core body temperature warmer because the heat dissipates less, I suppose. And therefore, you know, that's part of this huddling response, is to create a bigger mass of animals and keep them all warm. The ones on the outside, sadly, they can die of hypothermia tragedy. It's something that they're sacrificing themselves for the tribe, I guess. But huddling is another response that these animals have. Now, the other thing to say is a great word for you. Are you ready for a new word? You know, I love scientific terms. Creatures that live in the cold and love it are called psychrophiles. They're not psychophiles, psychro. It's from the Greek for cold. And we study these psychrophilic animals very closely. Certain fish live almost at zero, you know, and then the animals I'm talking about are kind of psychrophiles as well. They're specially adapted. Now, they've got versions of enzymes that you would have in your body that work better in the cold. All enzymes work best at certain temperatures. Ours work best at 37 body temperature. Psychrophilic organisms, their enzymes work better in the cold. So they're slightly different. And they have antifreeze as well, is very important. So the question is, are you a psychrophile? Do you love the cold? Now, let's move on to our last topic, probably the best one, winter swimming. If you jump in the sea and you love it every morning, maybe you should wear a t-shirt that says, I'm a psychrophile. I love the cold. Now, as I just said, it's amazing numbers now, and people have been studying this. The rate of winter swimming all over the Northern Hemisphere has gone up hugely because of COVID-19, because we all want to get out and do things, don't we? And we feel better if we jump into ice cold water. And it's a long sort of time people studying this in many ways. Is it good for you? Is it not? Is it a crazy thing to be doing? Well, guess what? We're almost certain it's fantastically good for you. And they were studying this in Scandinavian countries decades ago anyway. And more studies say it's a really good thing to do. Now, you must be cautious. You don't want to get hypothermia. As I mentioned, that's a very dangerous thing. And be very careful. Be with other people when you jump in, for instance. If you do feel really cold, get out of the water, for heaven's sake. Use your common sense. So you got to be cautious. But of course, many, many people do it safely. But keep an eye on that one. Now, what does it do for you? Well, as you all probably know by now, I'm obsessed with the immune system. Big immune boost. Fantastic. If you jump in the sea or a lake or whatever it is and come out, guess what? You double the number of white blood cells in your circulation. Now, can you imagine in a war doubling the number of troops to fight the germ? Fantastic. So the immune system gets massively boosted, which is great. Let's face it. That's number one. Number two, guess what? You feel good, don't you? I bet you now are in the realm of no pain, no gain. If we suffer a bit, the rebound is good. You get endorphins, the happy hormones, and dopamine goes up 2.5-fold. They've measured it in people.
That is fantastic.
You get a doubling of dopamine. That is the happy neurotransmitter in our body. So it's no wonder you feel great after a swim, because suddenly you're making your own little drugs, I suppose, that make you feel a bit better. So you get a surge. That could be in response to the pain. We make natural painkillers to dampen down the pain. It's so cold, you know, your body goes, oh God. And you make these things to make you feel a bit better, I guess, and survive. The third one is great circulation. You get the blood rushing around your body. And that's because you do get the blood leaving the skin and going back to the skin. You soup up the blood flow. Fantastic. And that's really good for you for all kinds of ways. And now, guess what? Now, this is a work in progress, but I love this one. Increased fertility. Can you believe it? There's a surge of estrogen in women, testosterone as well in men and women, and that might boost fertility. And if people who are in that age group who want to boost fertility, maybe jump in the sea. That might be a good thing. And an increase in libido. They've measured that as well.
Revitalizing tonic!
Now, that is probably tied into your mood is improved. And a sense of self-esteem goes up, actually, as well, which is a great thing. You feel a bit good about yourself because you've taken the courage of jumping in the the water on a freezing cold morning, you know. So again, a really good benefit there as well. And then, of course, it's a de-stressor. Now, that's the social bonding bit. Go with other people because that will de-stress you anyway. And then these changes in the in endorphins make your mood a bit better as well. And you feel good about yourself. So for heaven's sake, now I'm a coward. I don't like the sensation. But still, if you want to get a good kick, jump in the sea or in the lake. Even in having taken a cold shower can work, by the way, as well. So any of these things seem to work. And then the last study just came out recently, and this is such a great thing because it's a work in progress, obviously. They measured another brain chemical in winter swimmers. It's called RBM3. Now, this was discovered a few years ago. This stops neurons dying. It kind of protects your brain, this chemical. It's a natural chemical that keeps your neurons healthy, I suppose. And someone thought, let's measure it in the winter swimmers. And this is done in London. They had people who jumped into the Serpentine in London, which is a little lake in London. And the control group, very important in science to have controls. The control group are people exercising beside the Serpentine who weren't jumping in. Okay, see what I mean? And guess what? The ones who jumped in the water had higher levels of RBM3. The ones just exercising beside the pool didn't. It could have been something in the air, couldn't there? In the soil or whatever. It was the jumping in the water that boosted RBM3. So there you have it. Now, there's the best reason of all, isn't it? It'll keep your brain healthy as well. And RBM3 has been shown in animal models to stave off Alzheimer's, for instance, because it keeps the brain a bit healthier. So there's your other reason. The biochemical reason is to boost RBM3 levels. And then also, by the way, you'll burn more calories because you're a bit cold and you're shivering. Listen, it's a fantastic thing. Why don't I do it? Because I'm a coward. But maybe you're braver than me. And now, of course, you can come out of the water and you can have a cup of coffee with your friends and feel a bit warmer. I daren't mention the dry rope because that's a bit much, isn't it? But still, you know, winter swimming is really great. So, the science of cold, isn't it fantastic? We've evolved. All these creatures can sustain themselves in the cold. We humans can do it as well. If we wear furs and we have fire and so on, we can survive the cold weather as well. But best of all, maybe, is to jump into cold water or take a cold shower, because it will benefit your immune system. And there's a scientific basis for that. That is the science of the cold. And of course, every week you can hear me with Pat Kenny on News Talk when we have great chats about science. So tune in every week to News Talk.